Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello and welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing education and professional development for all UK-registered optometrists. You can gain 1 point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. I'm an IP optometrist based in Birmingham and an examiner for the college's scheme for registration. With case studies and in-depth conversations, each month we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. In this episode, we'll be exploring glaucoma. I'll be speaking to Mr. Imran Masood, a consultant ophthalmologist at the Birmingham and Midland Eye Centre.
In glaucoma, the disc is king. It is the appearance of the optic nerve that is critical to the diagnosis of glaucoma. It's not pressure, it's not the field, it's what the disc looks like.
But first, although glaucoma is diagnosed and managed by ophthalmologists, the role of optometrists in detecting, monitoring and referring the condition is very important. Paddy Gunn is the principal optometrist at Manchester Royal Eye Hospital, with a specialist qualification in glaucoma. He also works in a community practice.
The simplest way of thinking about it is a group of conditions that's all associated with disease at the optic nerve, which is very much associated with a progressive loss of visual field. And that sometimes, but not always, is associated with high eye pressure. So that's probably how I'd explain it to most of my patients.
And how would you explain to patients what the consequences are if the condition goes undetected or untreated?
It's always important to get that balance right and sort of tailor that very much individually to the patient. And so generally when we're seeing patients for the first time, I like to talk about the fact that it is a progressive condition that can get worse. And that's why it's so important and so fortunate that it's been picked up at the stage that it's had, because of the fact that we know that glaucoma is a very much a treatable condition, so that you can really give those reassurances about all of the different treatment options. I think sometimes when you've got a patient who's had glaucoma for a while, or perhaps is not attending for regular hospital visits, or may not be taking their eye drops as they should be, I think sometimes you've then got to be a little bit more explicit, I guess, about what the consequences are of that irreversible sight loss, because I think that you'd be doing a patient disservice if you weren't honest with them.
Do you find that there is a referral dilemma for optometrists when they suspect a patient might have glaucoma, but they don't want to make an unnecessary referral?
It's so difficult. So alongside working at the eye hospital, I also work a day a week in primary care at an independent optometry practice. And it's so frequent to have these dilemmas, whether to refer a patient or not. I think COVID has really exacerbated that kind of fear of unnecessarily referring patients, because you really don't want patients to have to go through the disruption of a hospital visit. We know that visits to the hospitalised service can be quite distressing for patients. They can be quite inconvenient, not to mention the fact that we know that the hospitalised service has huge backlogs. And so I don't think there's any optometrist who'd want to be making unnecessary referrals.
And so before referring, we have to consider all of the evidence and all the risk factors for the patient. To find out more from a doctor's point of view, I'm now joined by Mr. Imran Masood. He's a consultant ophthalmologist and director of the glaucoma service at the Birmingham and Midland Eye Centre. Hello, Imran.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. To start with, I'd like to ask you about something that I've been slightly worried about for a while now. When I first started seeing refractive surgery patients pre and post-operatively, I realised quite soon that for some patients, their intraocular pressure had dropped quite significantly after LASIK, sometimes by as much as 10 millimetres of mercury. And I was a bit worried that if these patients were to subsequently develop primary open-angle glaucoma later on in life and have a rise in IOP, it could go undetected if their IOP was still below 21 millimetres of mercury. So I'm thinking of perhaps, you know, a patient whose IOP dropped from 20 to 10 post-operatively, it would take a rise of more than 11 millimetres of mercury to be deemed suspicious on IOPs alone. And by then, there could be some irreversible optic nerve damage. Is my concern a valid one?
I think, Michelle, your concerns are very valid, and really they're borne out by my clinical experience. So one patient underwent LASIK treatment around 20 years ago in the early days of LASIK. And this rendered her corneas very thin. She, in essence, came to me with fairly advanced glaucoma, having been under the care of optometrists for many years. And every time she saw the optometrist, her pressure was always found to be within the normal range, so 16 to 18. The problem was, however, that because her corneal thickness was around 430, 440 microns, this measurement of her IOP was wildly out. So I know with conversion, we're told that you can't strictly convert based on linear algorithms, but nevertheless, you can add at least 8 or 9 points to her pressure, as much as you've alluded to in your opening statement. And if you add that, those levels of pressures, this patient has high pressure glaucoma. So it's not even NTG, it's high pressure disease. So I think your concern is very valid.
So for optometrists out there in practice, what are the key messages from your story, do you think?
I think the key messages are really, first of all, optometrists need to record in their records a history of laser vision correction. That's critical, and be aware of the possibility. Some of the other things that you need to be mindful of is a family history of glaucoma. Then on top of that, the myopia, which may also give the appearance of a suspicious disc. What I would recommend is that the threshold for referral is relatively low, particularly when you've got a few risk factors that are adding up there. So my view is you need to be on the lookout, because the IOP isn't going to tell you the full story, and optic nerve head assessment might be difficult. My clinical impression is certainly that if you are myopic, or certainly highly myopic, what happens is that the biomechanics of the eye are such, and the biomechanics of the optic nerve are such, that the optic nerve, I think, is more prone to pressure-induced damage. So that's another factor. I think you just need to be more aware that these patients who've had laser refractive surgery done will have other risks.
And just because they are no longer myopic doesn't mean those risks have gone away, because their eyeball is essentially the same eyeball, it's just the cornea that's changed.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So moving away from patients that have had laser vision correction, how would you describe a typical patient that is susceptible to developing glaucoma?
There's no typical patient as such. I think even straightforward primary open-angle glaucoma is a heterogeneous disease. It's not one condition. And we're all aware that different patients have different susceptibilities to the effect of pressure-induced damage. So that's another thing that we don't understand fully in glaucoma. Why is it that someone has a pressure of 30 and a normal optic nerve, and someone else has a pressure of 15 and what we call moth-eaten optic nerves with fairly advanced damage? And so that's the difficulty with glaucoma, that there is no typical patient. But if you said, what is the typical thing that I would advise optometrists to look for? One is the risk factors: age, race, family history. But also critically look at the optic disc. I think in the era of OCT, people are becoming less and less accustomed to looking at optic discs. And I think OCT is a useful adjunct. But I think the ability to look at the optic disc with a trained eye is still an extremely valuable diagnostic test for glaucoma. The more discs you look at with your own eyes, the better you will become at detecting glaucoma discs. And there's a saying one of my colleagues has is, in glaucoma, the disc is king. It is the appearance of the optic nerve that is critical to the diagnosis of glaucoma. It's not pressure, it's not the field, it's what the disc looks like. Because again, we know that patients can have something called cliff edge discs. So you can have fairly advanced disc damage and retain a normal visual field right up until the end, when the field then starts to accelerate in terms of loss and reduction.
So when you're actually looking at the optic disc, how would you describe a glaucomatous disc?
So there are lots of features of glaucoma on optic discs, and some are subtle, some are more obvious. But typically, I think it's important to look for notching. The infratemporal rim is the one that typically gets damaged first in glaucoma, so be attuned to looking particularly for the infratemporal area. Obviously, cupping, you can get diffuse cupping, and that's important. Disc hemorrhages are another important sign.
And by that, do you mean splinter hemorrhages?
Splinter hemorrhages at the optic nerve, yeah. They can be a sign of early glaucoma damage. So you can have a relatively healthy disc, but you can have a splinter hemorrhage. That may be a sign that someone is going to go on and develop glaucoma in the future. But there is something called the disc damage likelihood score, where there are certain features on the optic disc in terms of cup-disc ratio, which is relevant. And what I would suggest is that if every optometrist has in their examination room a chart on the wall which shows the disc damage likelihood score, then you're going to be much more likely to pick up people who have glaucomatous discs. The ideal way of diagnosing glaucomatous optic nerve head cupping is looking through a slit lamp with a binocular view with a fundus lens in a patient whose pupil's been dilated. That, I would say, is almost a gold standard.
So, Imran, you've mentioned that looking at the CD ratio, the cup-to-disc ratio, is really important. But actually, studies have shown that between different practitioners, the correlation isn't always that great. And so I came across a case recently where a parent of an autistic child was actually quite concerned because their optometrist seemed to think that the CD ratio in her child had altered significantly. And based on that information, the child was then referred for glaucoma assessment. Now, it could be that actually the CD ratio was just assessed differently between different practitioners. So even though OCT is a useful adjunct, it can be there as a backup, and also fundus photography as well, because that's an objective recording of the disc appearance.
Yeah, you make some great points there about the lack of objectivity of clinical assessment. And I think that, as you say, taking a fundus photograph, a photograph of the optic nerve, is a very useful way of looking for change. And I think that the more ways you can collect data about the optic nerve head structure, the better. And so I would say in an ideal world, if you can have a color photograph of the disc and an OCT, that is a great way of identifying or looking for change and looking for progression.
I asked Paddy Gunn about the thought process he goes through when screening for glaucoma in community practice.
Taking a really good history of a patient and trying to think about what particular risk factors they may have for glaucoma, maybe having a bit of a think about previous things that may have happened to them before in the past, any previous investigations, because you do get a number of patients that may have a slightly suspicious visual field or a slightly odd looking optic nerve. And so is there anything else that could be explaining some of the findings that you're seeing other than glaucoma? And then making the most of all of the brilliant tests that we've got, the variety of different methods of measuring eye pressure, looking at a really detailed optic disc assessment and visual fields assessment.
For optic nerve assessment, as an optometrist in practice, what are the key signs that you're looking for?
Well, I think that we have to be realistic about how much time that you have in a routine eye examination. I think if you have some suspicion, either from the history that the patient may have glaucoma, or if from your initial look at the optic nerve, you are that little bit more suspicious, I think that making sure that you've got a decent magnification lens is really important. And if you're struggling to get a view, think about dilation. I think sometimes we can be drawn too much by cup to disc ratio. And so maybe thinking more about that configuration of the neuroretinal rim. Are there any areas of thinning? Are there areas of any suspicion? Looking at that kind of area around the optic nerve, are there any other features? So changes such as disc hemorrhage, and thinking about some of those signs like that. The other thing to bear in mind is that sometimes I think that we've all been there where we've looked at an optic nerve, we thought, well, that doesn't look too bad to me. You've then done a visual field assessment on that patient and thought, oh, hang on a minute, that looks a little bit suspicious. There's never any harm in taking a patient back through after they've had a visual field and going back and having that second look and thinking, well, you know, there's a little bit of something going up at the top of the visual field here. I'm going to go back and have a really detailed look at the inferior part of the optic nerve. So I guess it's about sort of using your time wisely and then focusing your attention on areas that are most likely to fit in with the other sort of clinical findings.
Thanks, Paddy. Going back to you, Imran, how can optometrists minimise the risk of an unnecessary referral for suspect glaucoma?
The more that can be done to diagnose or refute glaucoma in the community, the better, really. And so I think, obviously, a history looking at risk factors, the ability to do pachymetry in primary care would be excellent, because a number of patients who are referred with ocular hypertension actually have thick corneas. So that would really be helpful.
How would you define a thick cornea? Is that greater than 550 microns?
Well, I think the average corneal thickness in the OAT study was about 550. I mean, there's different readings for average. Some people say that the average is actually around 530. But if we look at the OAT study, it was 550. So I think that if someone, let's say, has a corneal thickness of 580 microns and has a pressure of around 24, you probably don't need to refer that patient. And so although there's no real correction factor, you can be sensible about it. And you can say, for example, if someone's got a pressure of 25 and they've got a corneal thickness of 600 microns, at least some of that pressure is going to be related to the central cornea. And therefore, your threshold for referral changes. Now, how precisely it changes, I don't think has been defined in the literature or in recommendations. And so from my perspective, I think optometrists should be using as many tools as they can and should be using clinical common sense. I would say that just because someone's pressure is 24, they don't need referral, particularly if their cornea is on the thick side, for example, 600 odd. And you know, these are patients who, if there is concern, they can be monitored by optometry. I'm not sure if the funding's available for that, but that's the way we have to go if we're going to reduce the burden on the hospital eye service.
So we're now coming to the end of the second year of the COVID-19 pandemic, and we hear a lot about the burden on the NHS, and it is having a huge impact across the whole of the health service, including eye services. So Imran, as director of glaucoma, how has the COVID backlog affected your services?
Well, just like the whole of the NHS, even that 3 month, particularly the initial wave of the pandemic, where potentially millions of glaucoma appointments were missed and then had to be rescheduled, has had a huge impact, because we forget that every day we're seeing millions of patients, and 90 days without any elective care provision for something like glaucoma, which is based around follow-up and monitoring, is liable to have a huge impact. And I can tell you, as soon as I restarted my service in July, we were inundated with people who needed to have their surgery expedited, and we had to go through all of our waiting lists to try and do harm reviews and various other strategies like that to try and catch up. And we still haven't caught up.
So how do you prioritise, you know, which patient needs surgery sooner?
Well, what we're doing at the moment is the whole of the NHS is prioritising based on risk of morbidity caused by delay. And currently we're assigning every patient that we list for surgery a risk score or a risk number. But as you can imagine, there's a huge backlog. So what we've done in our hospital, and I think a number of hospitals have looked at innovative ways of dealing with the backlog, we've gone to insourcing and outsourcing solutions. So we have liaised with private external providers to try and help reduce the backlog by sending out some of our more urgent patients to these providers to get the surgery done and then come straight back in order to maintain some continuity. We've had to think outside the box.
And I guess the role that optometry can play is that they can try to ensure that they don't send unnecessary referrals into the NHS at the moment. So by following the patient up themselves and making sure that they've checked the NICE guidelines, that can contribute as well, can't it? That can help to relieve some of that pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think optometry can also help even with active glaucoma patients. So if patients do turn up, you might find that patients turn up to optometry because they can't get their NHS appointment. And that's another important role where optometrists can liaise with hospitalised services. Perhaps you might say do an extra field test or check the pressure for someone who turns up just for glasses who has a history of glaucoma, who might say it might be worth asking them when was the last time you were seen in the hospital? And if the reply is, well, it's been 18 months or 2 years, as is the case for a number of patients, then I think it's an excellent opportunity for the optometrist just to sort of make sure that the glaucoma hasn't gone rampantly out of control and whether the patient needs to be referred back urgently as a priority to the hospital eye service.
I asked Paddy Gunn if, in his experience, suspected glaucoma patients are ever monitored in community optometry rather than being referred on to the hospital eye service.
Well, I think that glaucoma is not an easy condition to diagnose, and this is why we have so many glaucoma suspects under the hospital eye service. I think that optometrists use sensible, pragmatic decisions and kind of look at that balance to whether they feel that they've got the skills and the knowledge to be able to effectively monitor that patient or whether they feel that they need to refer that patient. And I think that we have to recognise the fact that the GOS eye examinations don't really provide or cover adequately for optometrists to be paid sufficiently to be able to monitor glaucoma patients in the community. And this is why enhanced schemes are so important to make sure that optometrists have all of the right support, training and payment to be able to monitor patients in the community. And I think that with the development of electronic referral pathways, including imaging and things like that, that should hopefully improve things further. So optometrists will perhaps maybe feel a little bit more empowered to be able to hang on to patients that little bit longer if they can easily access that advice.
Imran mentioned that optometry can also help by doing some basic tests if the patient attends for an eye examination, but hasn't had their routine glaucoma monitoring hospital appointment for a long time. If you don't actually know what their baseline data is, how do you know whether or not their condition has progressed and whether or not you need to notify the hospital eye service?
It's a really difficult decision to make. And so if you've got a patient that's ocular hypertensive and they've got a normal eye pressure, I think that you can safely say that they're doing okay. If you're unsure, and again, I have had patients where I've felt that they've progressed. So in those cases, I've written to the hospital who's responsible for their care just with an update, just to let them know that that patient really needs to be seen as a priority. So to any optometrists out there who feel a little bit unsure about whether a patient needs to be seen or not, just send all the information in. Other than the time taken to do the referral letter, there's absolutely nothing to lose and potentially so much to gain.
So Imran, that leads me on to another aspect. If patients who are under the hospital eye service for glaucoma, and perhaps they are stable but develop a cataract, can they still be treated? Can they be operated on by another provider of cataract services? Or do they have to be sent back to the main hospital where their glaucoma is also being managed?
It's a very important question. The issue here is that cataract surgery in the presence of comorbidity is never straightforward. So there's good evidence in the literature that glaucoma patients are much more liable to get post-operative pressure spikes after cataract surgery because their drainage meshwork is compromised. And the trauma of surgery, plus or minus the use of frequent topical steroids that happens after cataract surgery, some patients can get into real trouble with that. Certainly with patients nowadays who have glaucoma and cataract, almost the standard of care now is to perform cataract surgery in combination with an angle procedure. So, for example, an eye stent or a canaloplasty or something else similar to that. And there's certainly, in my practice, I have found that this has massively reduced the risk of post-operative pressure instability. And also, it's the one opportunity the patient has to reduce their medication load. And reduction of medication load with good pressure control is a very important part of glaucoma management.
So Imran, if patients are struggling to get checkups and they've got glaucoma, it's already been diagnosed, are they able to pursue a private consultant review anywhere?
So again, a really important question. Our aim in the NHS is to give everyone the best possible care that we can, but we are limited by resources, and the pandemic has just exacerbated things. So I think the private option is definitely an option. And interestingly, over the pandemic, I've seen a number of patients who've had surgery either delayed or they were reluctant to come out and even attend their hospital eye service appointments. In fact, if I share a case history with you, this was a patient of mine who I'd looked after privately during the pandemic period, basically disappeared off the radar for many, many months. And when he came back to me, this is a monocular patient, he came back with a pressure of 70 in his only eye. And so he really had to be expedited. And glaucoma is a progressive disease. You know, patients can become unstable at any point. And we have been seeing a lot of unstable patients over the last 18 months. I think the biggest message also is for optometrists to encourage patients to go and get their glaucoma assessed. If patients can afford to go privately, by all means, go and get it assessed. That's the main thing. If the NHS backlogs are bad and you can afford it, then I think that's helpful, that's useful.
Mm. If you had to have a take-home message for optometrists at the end of this podcast, what would it be?
I would say the take-home message is that glaucoma is a difficult disease to diagnose. It's a difficult disease to manage, and keep practicing, keep learning. At the primary care end, it's really the optometrists who pick up the glaucoma and put the patients in front of people like me so I can treat them. If you don't find the patients, I can't treat them. So the key message is get well educated, get well trained so you can identify these patients.
Imran Masood, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
I asked Paddy Gunn the same question. From an optometrist's point of view, what is the take-home message?
I think that there's so many different things that can raise suspicion for glaucoma. So I think it's just trust yourself, trust your judgment, do all of the relevant tests that you think that may help you make that decision. And if you're unsure, just bring the patient back if you can, repeat those tests again. And if you're still unsure, I think that that's the stage to look to get a referral. I think another useful tip is that if you're unsure about whether you needed to make that referral or not, if you think it's a bit of a borderline case, I think acknowledging that in your referral letter and asking for feedback just to make sure that you get some feedback on your referral is a really useful thing to do as well.
Paddy Gunn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. For more information on glaucoma, go to our website, docket.info, and search for Sound Optometry to find the additional reading materials. By listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain 1 point covering standards of practice, ocular disease, and communication. Next time, we'll be looking at vitreoretinal disorders. We'd really appreciate it if you spread the word about the podcast, tell your colleagues to listen, or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.